This next session, I want to continue looking at some modernists and the ways in which science, in particular, has been used. The new atheists clearly use science as the enemy of the faith. With Dawkins especially, of course, evolution is the key scientific theory which they feel gives them the upper hand. And so, of course, we're familiar with, in history, the way in which the scientific revolution, which started in a Christian context, and most of the early scientists were devout believers, there was no antagonism, quite the opposite, between science and faith. But we're all familiar, you know, since Galileo, and then, of course, since Darwin, this sort of idea that somehow science is hostile to the faith. And, of course, as much as both some scientists and many theologians have tried to paint a different picture, as soon as you get some headway on trying to show that these two things are not antithetical, you know, you get something like the new atheism, which just sort of drives the wedge even deeper between science and faith. So in responding to the new atheism, many folk like McGrath, of course, who is a trained scientist himself, and Plantinga, who's a philosopher, many of them are trying to be very careful in not only rebutting the new atheists and defending theism, but in doing so in a way that doesn't feed this kind of science is the enemy idea, or that there's a division between science and faith. So it's a tricky thing to do, because of course you could react to all of this and just do so in a way that seems that you're very anti-science. I hope you didn't sense that in the way I dealt with it. Although I did give evolution a good working over, I'm not at all anti-science, and I don't think science is the enemy, and I don't think we need to fear science. And I hope in this next session to show how, in fact, science can work as friend to the faith. But before we get into that, no questions? Great. Okay. I thought if I gave you just the briefest moment, I could get away with it. But that man, has his hand is so fast, he's just shot up there. Serjan. Serjan, please.
A few maybe critical remarks.
What?
First of all, I think that this kind of apologetics maybe can be a bit unproductive. Mm-hmm. I'm more for dialogue with atheists, because I think that we can learn a lot from them. Mm-hmm. And second thing that, yeah, you mentioned at the end of your lecture about politics and religion, mm-hmm. about American evangelicals and other stuff. I'm be aware when theology and religion goes to politics, you will get violent.
Get violent.
Yeah. I'm telling that from my own experience from former Yugoslav Republic. Mm-hmm. And just remember apartheid in South Africa, mm-hmm. when Reformed theologians mm-hmm. justified apartheid with the Bible. Mm-hmm. And yeah, remember Third Reich theologians. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have to be really careful and aware.
No, I'm glad for both of those points. And even some of the most tolerant and accommodating of theologians feel a little exasperated at trying to establish dialogue with the new atheism because they don't seem to really want that kind of dialogue. But your point that a secular context, a secular world, is something that we should approach as Christians with an openness to dialogue, I absolutely accept. Critical on all sorts of levels, both simple human respect. But more than that, of course, because it is part of our witness in this world, to be those that love even our enemies. And so I think we need to be very, very careful, and I hope I didn't step over the bounds, probably I did. It's intriguing in watching Alistair McGrath, because he's trying very, very carefully not to fight fire with fire. But even he slips from time to time into a little bit of humor. And humor is very dangerous. Now we see with the New Atheists the vitriolic, you know, ridicule, humiliating Christians believe. And we want to be careful that we don't then respond tit for tat. Because we do not fight with the weapons of this war, of this world. So it's a good caution. And indeed, one of the examples I'm going to get onto shortly, I think, will answer much of that question, the fruitfulness of dialogue. But from time to time, you know, we have to sort of pop the bubble as well. And so the Bible is not averse from time to time to using sarcasm. But we have to be very careful. Predominantly, we want to engage in dialogue, and dialogue that is respectful and is serious. In regard to, you know, religion and politics, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think there's very few of us that have been fortunate enough if you're of any age, to have escaped some, you know, in this country, of course, Northern Ireland, but in many parts of the world, you know, we can see how religion and politics can become very bloody very quickly. And so, indeed, there's much of the criticisms that the New Atheists are making, which we'd agree with. I mean, we're not going to, none of us are going to say, oh, well, you misunderstood 9/11. Actually, it wasn't so bad. I mean, we all can agree that this is religion gone mad. But as Rosie said, where is Rosie? Tell us what you said. Come on, this is your chance.
Think about the football.
Yes.
It's like saying that because some people who watch football are football hooligans, therefore everybody who watches football is a football hooligan, and everybody who watches sport is a football hooligan, is a hooligan, and therefore we should get rid of it all.
Exactly. Thank you, Rosie. Perfect rebuttal. You see, that's exactly the problem. The fact that there's aberrant forms of religion, does that mean that all religion is essentially misguided? You know, and you know that you may feel that way. And indeed, that's why part of the impetus to the Enlightenment was, you know, the terrible religious wars that had preceded it. People just got sick to death of it, you know, and the corruption of the church. So, but these are arguments that are, I try to focus, if you like, on the more intellectual arguments. The arguments that are more anecdotal, more historical, that is a lot of the rhetoric. And that's where it gets to, you know, religion and politics. And there's, I mean, should people of faith not be involved in political discourse? You know, of course they should be, and we recognize that. But it's a difficult thing to discuss. But the film we're going to watch, are we doing that tonight?
Tomorrow.
The film will satisfy you immensely, because he really goes to task on this issue, and he makes exceptionally good points. And we, as apologists, if that's what we're doing this course for, have to become adept at sorting out what is appropriate fears that the secular mind has from inappropriate overreactions. So it's appropriate to be fearful. You know, if a guy sits next to you on a plane, you know, and he starts chanting Allah Akbar, you know, it's appropriate to get a little bit worried. But of course, if you realize that in fact that is a normative prayer that a Muslim should pray 5 times a day, then that doesn't necessarily carry the connotation that we think it does. And so we have to sort of balance this sort of thing of something that might create in us a fear with understanding, and be able to separate out the light from the darkness, separate out, you know, what we can indeed respect and allow and tolerate as an appropriate form of religious. We might not agree with it, but we say you have a right to have your religious faith, and we are a tolerant and open society. versus those things which we need to draw a line on and say, you know, these things we cannot tolerate. And that's, you know, that's not an easy discussion to have. And the more inflammatory the discussion, the less understanding there is, the more fear there is. People start throwing bombs, people back in, they're back, and that's what you saw, you know, in Yugoslavia. I mean, people back into their ethnic and their religious traditions, and you start demonizing the opposition. So you're absolutely right, and I thank you for that warning. Other questions about all this? Yes, John.
Just a small point on what this gentleman just said.
I think you said what was very appropriate, because we also have to remember that Mr. Dawkins would use what he believes to justify rampant abortion, rampant euthanasia, those sorts of things. So I think it's right for you to critique in that way, because he would also use those sorts of things to underpin his thinking.
Yeah, it's part of the human condition that we often deal with one evil in a way that invites another evil, you know. And so as J.I. Packer, my professor at Regent College, used to love to say, the reactions of man worketh not the righteousness of God. The reactions of man worketh not the righteousness. So we need to be careful we don't react to the new atheism. There was another question here, was it?
Did you, Irene? Oh, well, just a quick one. Yeah. You said, talking to John about, you said, talking said, go as far as certainly does not exist. I've been wondering whether that was the almost bit, which I was surprised to hear, was the thing that got put on the buses. You know, he did this advertising thing.
Yeah.
And he was told, maybe he was told by the advertising standard agency, he couldn't actually say God does not exist because of evidence, for evidence reasons. Or was that something he actually said in his books, as well as...
No, that's a direct quote from his book.
His book, okay, yeah. That's all I wanted to know.
No, it's a direct quote. He always puts the almost
in. I thought the almost was required by the advertising standard.
Well, that may have been a case there. I doubt it. I doubt that. But certainly in his book, it's a direct quote. And he actually explains the almost in his book, because he says, yes, philosophically, you can never ultimately absolutely prove a negative. Therefore, okay. But it's almost certainly impossible. Interesting, I heard from our Finnish brother over here that in Finland they had a similar advertising campaign on the buses to put that on the buses. It lasted 3 days because the Muslim bus drivers refused to drive the buses. So sometimes Islamic intolerance, you know, can work in favorable ways. They're not going to drive these infidel buses, and so they had to, and it was the church, apparently the Lutheran church, which had given permission, you know, to have these, you know, said no, we won't be offended, go ahead. Yes, sir.
Is Dawkins really says that evolution is the only alternative hypothesis to God, is that what him trying to prove a negative by saying there are no other hypotheses?
Well, it could be, but I think it's just that he's trying, and partly it's rhetoric, but I think he's probably correct, that for a long time, you know, biology just was incredibly mysterious. And so people came up with all sorts of things, like vitalism and so on, sort of supernatural explanations, even though they weren't necessarily theistic. They were sort of supernatural. It just boggled the mind what goes on in biology. It still does. And so for him, this is, you know, Dennett's thing, you know, the dangerous sort of hypothesis. You know, natural selection that Darwin came up with is an amazing mechanism to sort of explain away something that seems highly improbable, highly mysterious. And I think in Dawkins' mind, Darwin is just an absolute giant for this single reason, that he came up with the only alternative mechanism besides God. The only one. But my point is, of course, if this is the only theoretical mechanism, well, then pretty much any evidence for it is going to be accepted as, you know, strong. Because you already have nowhere else to go other than become a theist. And so this, I think, is, in fact, what we see working out practically, that many people say, well, you know, if God didn't do it, you know, evolution must have done it, and if evolution didn't do it, then I'm going to have to sort of give credence to the fact that God may have done it. So at all costs, I have to sort of somehow make evolution work. And so this really makes a lot of the science that goes on under the rubric of evolution sort of a little bit biased. I'm not saying entirely, but I think there is this sort of, there is this bias. And so people like Jay Gould, who come out and say something rather unhelpful, like punctuated equilibrium, you know, that in actual fact the fossil record shows massive jumps, you know, he's kind of marginalized because he's not sort of, you know, and then you get someone like Behe, who does believe in evolution, but also says, look, the complexity of the cell is irreducibly complex. You know, he's vilified. So there's not really an openness of scientific discussion here. And I think partly it's because of what he's saying. There's really two alternatives.
When he says it's the only alternative, is that an appeal to historical narrative that it's the only one that we've seen come up yet, or is it a philosophical, this is the only possible?
No, I think scientifically it's the only thing that's really been presented that has any kind of credence scientifically.
Okay. And how strong is it then? You talk about people like Jay Gould and Behe and are there big flaws in it?
Well, I don't want us to get into debating evolution, but personally, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a scientist, but from my understanding and my looking at it, I do think there are significant holes, certainly in macroevolution, the idea that from the Big Bang to consciousness, everything is explained on natural premises. I think there are massive holes, both philosophically and evidentially, in terms of the sheer evidence. In fact, the more science discovers on evidentiary nature, such as the complexity of the cell, the more unlikely it becomes. Because you have a finite age of the Earth, of the universe. That doesn't change much, except occasionally when the Hubble telescope discovers that there are stars that are older than the universe. Then we have to do a little revision. So you make it a little bit bigger. But it's essentially finite. But the complexity grows. And I think biology is only just scratching the surface. I mean, biology is now kind of where we were 100 years ago in physics. 100 years ago in physics, you know, you had Newtonian mechanics, you had Lord Kelvin saying, you know, we pretty much figured everything out, we have all the equations we need, we just need to work it all out. But he said in his speech at Glasgow, turn of the century, 1900, said that there are two little clouds on the horizon. And the clouds he was referring to was Einstein's first and second laws. And the cloud of Einstein grew and grew until now we know that Newtonian mechanics, physics, is fast simplification, and all the infinite complexity and bewildering mystery of quantum mechanics is now, you know, that's what we accept. And I think biology now, you know, we've got 30 years ago we had Francis Crick and Watson, you know, here in the Eagle Pub, you know, working out the double helix and all that. And, you know, now we're all excited. Yes, we can figure out, we found the code, we've sequenced it a couple of years ago, and we've discovered. But I think it's just a matter of time before the Einstein comes up, who sort of says, look, the simplified sort of deterministic structure we have here that we're making great inroads on, there's levels of complexity deeper. And there's lots of signs that that is the case. Now, I may be wrong, but even at this moment, biology is showing more and more levels of complexity. You have a finite amount of time. How did this all arise through naturalistic mechanisms? Dawkins has to again and again and again postulate that science will in the future discover natural mechanisms. Because at the moment we have natural selection to explain this a little bit, but we don't have natural mechanisms to explain the rest. So he's positing a lot into the future. But I don't think we have to necessarily deny microevolution. There is mounting evidence in the last 10 years, specifically in the DNA sequencing, for the first time, I would say, in a while, actually increases the probability of organic evolution among living species. For the macro picture, I think there's massive holes. I really do. That there's a naturalist explanation. Yeah.
I've got to come in on a couple of things. You're not quite right about a few things.
Okay.
Behe is vilified because his research is bunk. It's really bad. He applies the scientific method for his theory of irreducible complexity, and he has found consistently no evidence to support it. In fact, multiple evidences to refute his claims. But he still holds to his original thesis, which is not the scientific method. He's the exact example of a Christian trying to do science to kind of use this, what theistic evolution is termed the God of the gaps idea, where you try to find gaps in science and you immediately plug them with God, where actually in a few years' time you're probably going to find a pretty sound naturalistic explanation for how things happen. So Behe is rightly vilified and is very dangerous for evangelicals to just thrust their support behind him without fully understanding the negative connotations of the research he does, because it's not good research.
Well, you and I have to have a long cup of coffee over that one. But it's true that he is critiqued as not really acknowledging the evidence that's there. I think he gives evidence for what he does say in terms of complexity.
But each of those evidences has been shown to be.
Well, right, and so what
both Christian and non-Christian.
But it's not that he doesn't have evidence for his theory. The critique is that he doesn't acknowledge the counter evidence. And that was in the Dover trial that came out by the simple rhetorical device of the lawyer saying, "Have you read every single paper that has been produced that presents counter evidence?" And he had to say, "Well, no, I haven't." So if that means you're not a good scientist, then you're right. He hasn't read every single paper that every single research PhD student has done, which claims in that paper to present evidence to defeat his argument. I would like to find one scientist who has read every paper in his field by every graduate who's coming out to try and challenge his idea. So, you know, I think we can say, well, you know, maybe on that basis he's not a good scientist. But I think his argument still carries weight, personally.
I don't think, I think there's a difference between having to have read every paper and having to read the one paper that, like, quite systematically refutes your evidence.
But that's the qualitative judgment. I mean, that's a subjective judgment. He said that in that trial, he said, "I've read the ones that to my mind seem the most," and the rest, he said, I dismissed because they in his evaluation, they're not really, refuting. Now, someone else, no doubt the authors of this paper, would debate that. But I think this is precisely how science does operate. I mean, Jay Gould punctuated equilibrium. I mean, the paper's flying backwards and forwards over that, for decades. I mean, this is how science works. People defend and attack theses. It's very seldom that you can sort of say, well, one paper sort of decisively destroys an entire hypothesis just like that. I think you gain over time credibility for your argument, or your argument is discredited over time. I think that time has to yet elapse with regard to irreducible complexity, personally speaking. I'm not saying that there aren't strong reactions going the other way.
Okay. But the other thing is that I think you've nearly fallen into the God of the Gaps trap, where you have effectively separated God from evolution, and you're presenting them as you can either have God or evolution, and if you accept God, you can't accept evolution. Whereas actually, like, the growing consensus among evangelicals is a theistic evolution, that it's the whole kind of the gun thing. Guns don't kill people, it's the person who pulls the trigger, in the same way as evolution can create life.
No,
and
that's
produce a consciousness, but it can be God who pulled the trigger on evolution.
Yeah, and I don't want us to necessarily debate evolution here, because there are many theistic evolutionists, and as you say, it's sort of a growing thing. And as I pointed out, both Plantinga and Alistair McGrath accept the theory of evolution in their rebuttals of Dawkins. And so what I'm talking about here is a naturalistic explanation. You know, so I use the word naturalism there. And I talk about macroevolution, which is a sort of evolution as a metaphor, which says everything happens purely by natural force all the way through, without the need of a God. And I don't think any Christian can really go there.
Well, I'm
so many Christians say biological evolution in here may well have become established. But they would still want to say that God directed it, which of course Dawkins would say is nonsense. It destroys the power of natural selection to talk about a God-directed evolution. He would say that they're being illogical. That's another discussion whether we think those two things go together or not. But certainly, I would say that you could accept certain evolutionary processes as being verified. But the real question is the design of the universe, this whole thing, fully explicable on natural premises? Or is there a designer? And I would say even Hawking...
It's that or, that's yeah. the one I have a problem with. So even if you could show, you could scientifically prove, say in 10,000 years' time, that we've got all these laws and they perfectly account for every natural phenomenon we see, that still doesn't refute the idea of God being behind it all. Because there has to...
Well, it doesn't refute deism. It doesn't refute deism. That's the
mechanism and agency thing.
It doesn't refute deism. And in fact, that's why, you know, a lot of a certain kind of religion has, and theology has managed to continue quite happily, except in the premises of naturalism. Because God, in a sense, by definition, is either completely outside of the universe or completely suffuses the universe. And as long as you have only a transcendent or only an immanent God, you're a happy camper. Because naturalism can explain everything. But as soon as you believe in a God who intervenes through revelation, who speaks a word that makes an impact and breaks the cause and effect closed system, then you're talking about, I believe, evangelical Christianity. You're talking about historical Orthodox Christianity.
Well, I still think
and you're not talking about Chardin and many formulations of the faith that were designed to avoid a conflict. You have a conflict there between naturalism and the Christian Orthodox faith. God who intervenes miraculously, supernaturally, and breaks in the hope we have that Randall spoke this morning, is that death is not the end. This says eventually our star will die. Eventually our species will evolve. That's the direction of natural law. If nothing intervenes. Our hope is that something has intervened. Death is not the end. God has spoken. God has entered. God raised Jesus from the dead, who was in the grip of natural processes. That to me is the essence of Christianity.
Yeah.
It's an intervening God. And I'm not satisfied with the transcendent God. I'm not satisfied with an immanent God. An immanent God is a pantheist God. A transcendent God is a deist God. The God of the Bible is the transcendent, immanent, intervening God. And that's, to my mind, where we do have a conflict with naturalism. I don't believe that the conflict with naturalism necessarily brings a conflict with science. And that's what I tried to say earlier. Because I don't think science needs to be defined as naturalism. Naturalism is a belief system.
Yeah.
Science is a methodology of investigation that's very powerful, that came out of Christian roots. And it's wonderful. I don't think naturalism and evolution are necessarily the same thing. Dawkins tries to make them the same thing. Many popular people think of evolution as a sort of a paradigm of a natural explanation from Big Bang to consciousness. I think that's a misappropriation of the word, but that's how many people use it. That's why I like to make a distinction between microevolution and macroevolution. And say perhaps evolution as a mechanism, natural selection, does operate and accounts for much of the diversity of species. I don't have a problem with that, and Christians would want to, theistic evolutionists would say, well, God is somehow behind that. I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem when that is expanded to become naturalism. And so I don't want to create conflicts, and I heard that in your question, you know, silly evangelicals creating conflicts and, you know, getting egg on their face, God of the gaps. I agree with a lot of that sentiment. You know, the worry that we're going to become another, you know, a sort of flat earth sort of crowd. I understand that worry. And we need to be careful about that. But we also have to worry about something else, which is denying what the Word of God says about who God is. He could have been a deistic God if he chose. He could have done that. He could have left us to get on with it. But he did not. And we need to bear testimony to that, even though it brings us in confrontation with the naturalist.
But you don't have to be a naturalist to say that natural laws govern things until God intervenes. God can set in motion laws which he can then later break.
Yes, that's God. Right. Fine, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that. And I think he's broken infrequently.
Okay.
Now we can just debate, did he break in with the creation of Adam or not? That's a big discussion at the moment. You know, did he break in the creation of the first cell or not? But, you know, the fact that he broke in, to my mind, you know, starts with the resurrection. But then we look at the whole of the Word of God and we see that his testimony is that he has broken in many times. John?
I thought the Christian understanding of immanence was not the same as pantheism.
Well,
which you seem to suggest just now. I thought it was the same as like Christian or theistic evolutionists might say that God is constantly sustaining the laws of the universe by his input.
But if that's all you say, you're absolutely right.
That's not all you're saying, but so I'm just querying the...
You're right.
Your contrast between...
I'm being a little bit provocative there, pushing back, because I mean, theologically, immanentism, I mean, God is immanent is well established, it's something we believe, that God is everywhere sustaining this universe, and hence the problem with the God of the gaps. That if a God of the gaps, a God who only intervenes and isn't sustaining, is a lesser God than the God of Scripture. God is everywhere present, God is everywhere sustaining. He is immanent in that sense. But a lot of times, of course, when we say that, we think that that brings God back into the picture. But if God is everywhere present, then he is nowhere visible. You see, if God is everywhere present in every process and every aspect of history, that is an affirmation of God's immanence and involvement. But if we do not add to that, that God is transcendent, and if we do not add to that, that God at certain points breaks in and makes himself visible through an action, then we have the pantheist God.
But isn't that the relationship between the transcendent and the immanent? Is that because those connect, you could call that intervention?
No, not at all. For a transcendent God to come imminently in is not to intervene. Precisely to sustain something is not to intervene with it. Like the guy who's juggling the balls, he's just keeping that going. He's not intervening in it. He's making it happen. But because his interventions are so uniform and so continuous, there's no break in the balls going round and round. The intervention comes when he goes like this and puts it behind his back. Then he intervened.
Yeah, that's what I meant. That wasn't what I was saying earlier. But I'm not clear that you need to have a separate category of intervention.
That's what I'm arguing for. I think we absolutely need to have it.
Rightly and orthodoxly and historically, the Christian doctrine of transcendence and immanence. And
I don't believe we do use that rightly. I believe that when we talk about God's immanence and God being everywhere, and we worry about the God of the gaps, we are actually locking God out of intervention.
You've got a transcendent God at the same time, and you've got the two together, right?
The transcendent means he is not breaking in. He's out there.
No, I don't think it does.
Well, I mean, the notion of transcend means you're up and above, in a way.
That means you're not closed into the immanent system. He is immanent, but he is also transcendent, therefore he is able to intervene.
Ah! I'm with you. Therefore he is able. You're absolutely right. If God was only immanent, he would not be able to come in. If he is transcendent, he is certainly able to intervene. The question is, has he?
Yeah.
I'm glad. You admit that he has. I do too, and I label that intervention. Because you can conceive a transcendent God who has not intervened. That's what deism is. You know, we had centuries of that conviction. People who were absolutely solid on the transcendence of God.
Who hasn't intervened for a long time anyway.
Except right at the very beginning. So therefore, it is possible to conceive of a transcendent God who has not intervened. And therefore, it is necessary, in my mind, to bring in this extra category. Especially now. because no one wants to talk about intervention, because that brings us into conflict. Immanentism, what can you say about it? By pantheism, I mean, God is everywhere. How can you possibly say anything one way or the other about it? Transcendent God, there may be a God up there, fine. But a God who breaks in and makes himself visible, now you're talking. Now you've got a stake in the ground. And that's what historic Christianity is God planting a stake in the ground around which we undeniably have to make a decision. Either God has spoken or he hasn't. And I think that requires a different word. But we can talk more over coffee. I said I've got two coffee companions here.
I just want to publicly affirm that I need a lot of coffee to blow.
We need to move on. But I'm delighted to have this, because behind all this is, of course, an intermural discussion going on within evangelicalism about the status of theistic evolution. And theistic evolution, is powerfully kind of present at the moment, because it seems to avoid a lot of conflict. And it does avoid some appropriate worries about God of the gaps. And I think there's appropriate worries there. But I also have worries in another direction, which is whilst evangelicals are, you know, concerned not to become flat earthers, the rest of the culture is being essentially captivated by naturalism. And what stands up against naturalism? A deistic God who is transcendent does not stand up against naturalism. An immanent God who is everywhere does not stand up against naturalism. That's why you can have forms of pantheism that are essentially atheistic, in the sense that they don't believe in a particular God. Yeah.
This is what you just said is what worries me about all of this. Is that in school evolution is taught as fact. This is what happened. Every time I go to some National Trust or something, and you see the introductory video, it's always about when evolution started and all of this. And I'm sitting there thinking, No. But what has happened in popular culture is that evolution is accepted as fact. Therefore, naturalism, therefore must be fact.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's what worries me about it, is that people aren't having this dialogue about God or not, because evolution is true. And therefore,
yeah, I mean, if naturalism explains everything, then you can believe in naturalism plus God if you want. But he's entirely superfluous.
Mm, yeah.
So we need to leave it there. We need to move on to our second lecture of the morning. And you fellas can gang up on me later. Okay? I want to talk positively about science. And I want to talk a little bit about Carl Sagan. Because Carl Sagan is not well known now, but he was, in his day, in the 70s and 80s, and into the 90s even, very, very well known. He was the Richard Dawkins of that period. He was the publisher and publicizer of science and its wonders and its explanatory power. And he was an agnostic. That was his official position. He did not pursue attacking religion or faith, but rather he spent a lot of his time expounding the wonders and the power of science, including macroevolution. And he produced he was a scientist in his own right. He worked on the Viking Mars project, but he wrote over 400 articles, 29 books. He put together a book and a film series called Cosmos, which went on at the time to become one of the best-selling and most widely distributed, most watched documentary in all of history. Hundreds of millions of people watched it around the globe. It essentially promoted naturalism, this idea that you can start with the Big Bang, and his favorite phrase, you know, billions and billions and billions of years, and you would end with quantum. The whole thing is entirely naturalistic, naturally explicable development. And died in 96, rather young, still only 62 years old. But he died with many accolades. Very winsome writer. His books were every bit as well written as Dawkins, but had a much more poetic thrust to them. Not a hostile kind of a word in him. Just a lovely man. You can certainly enjoy his writings from that point of view. There's some interesting aspects about Sagan that I want to draw your attention to. First of all, he was the man behind SETI, S-E-T-I. This acronym is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And he initiated this search for alien intelligent life at a time when the intellectual elite was intensely scornful of such ideas. This was looking for little green men. This is sort of a crazy pursuit for a serious scientist to be involved. And serious scientists were beyond superstitious beliefs that there might be fairies or there might be aliens. And so the fact that Sagan would risk his reputation to get involved in such a quest, despite the skepticism of his peers, is really quite quite interesting in itself. Not only did he initiate that, of course it continues to today, but he even wrote a book called Contact. This is one effort at fiction. It's a novel. And it's about a young scientist who is interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So it's somewhat autobiographical.
Has it been made into a film?
And it was made into a film.
Yeah, with Jodie Foster.
With Jodie Foster. And it's a very, very interesting film to watch because it's a hypothetical scenario. If there were aliens, what would it be like to make contact with them? And so it's a bit of a sci-fi movie, except it has very serious arguments going on. And throughout the film and in the book, we discover that there are two heroes. As you have in any film, there is the young scientist who is scorned because she is interested in searching for alien life. And she uses radio telescopes to listen to the noise coming in, thinking that if there is intelligent life out there, there will be some signals of intelligence that we can pick up. And she is one of the heroes, but there has to be a love interest, right? It's Hollywood. So there is another hero, a young man who's a man of faith. And throughout the film, we have this dialogue going on between religion and faith. And she is the skeptic. I need evidence. And he is the man who said, I couldn't live without believing that there's something more than just matter. And they have this debate all the way through the film. And at the end, of course, they discover there is alien life. And what's very, very interesting in the film is that she, the aliens send a message, build a spacecraft. She gets to go in the spacecraft to go and visit with the aliens. And comes back, and she's agog because of her meeting with the aliens. And she tells the whole watching world about how her encounter with the aliens. And they're all amazed until it is discovered that there is no proof because she went through some sort of time bubble that erased all the recording devices that she took with her. And so suddenly everyone sort of starts saying, well, wait a minute. Yeah, you're a prominent scientist and now you're telling us something we have to believe in faith. The film ends, as does the book, with her chastened, recognizing that sometimes maybe there are things we just don't have enough evidence for, but that doesn't mean they aren't true. Sagan? Was that Carl Sagan really arguing that? Making a film about it? In the end, it is the man of faith who is vindicated in the film. It's stunning. Now, it was not unusual at the time of the film, because at the time of the film, there was a popular TV series called X-Files, right? And you had a similar setup. You know, you had the two heroes, a man and a woman, and one is a skeptic and one is a believer and believes in all sorts of wacky things. And you have this dialogue backwards and forwards, you know, reason and faith, belief and skepticism. And of course, you know, there's a love interest there too. So the setup, if you just watch this movie, you say, oh, it's just another movie like that. And the guy on the side of faith, he kind of wins out in the end. End of Hollywood story. But this is Carl Sagan.
Is the film faithful to the book on that point?
It's, on that point, it's faithful to the book, but it's not faithful enough. Because the book is even more serious on this. That is what is stunning about this. It's stunning enough that he would make this point. Then we read, I want to come back to that. Then we read that actually Carl Sagan, for the last 20 years of his life, was involved in a dialogue with people of faith. Let me read some excerpts from a Newsweek article after he died called Unbeliever's Quest. A man of science, Carl Sagan didn't want prayers. He wanted proof. He died still waiting for evidence. Carl Sagan, the famous scientist and author, died late last year at the untimely age of 62, resisting to the very end the one temptation to which almost everyone else submits to, that is the temptation to believe. Not that the kingdom of heaven held no interest for Sagan, an astronomer who, though he found the solar system wonderful, nonetheless it was too confining for his speculations on cosmic origins, human consciousness, and evolution. For most of the last decade of his life, he engaged in a wide-ranging dialogue with religious leaders on the question whose answer held the potential to put either preachers or cosmologists out of business, namely, does God exist? He argued the negative, although his formal position was agnostic, awaiting proof. Sagan spent a lot of time talking with Joan Campbell, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. Sagan was fascinated by the phenomena that educated adults, with the wonders of science manifest all around them, could cling to beliefs based on the unverifiable testimony of observers who died 2,000 years ago. "You're so smart, why do you believe in God?" he once exclaimed to Campbell in one of their dialogues. She found this a surprising question for someone who had no trouble accepting the existence of black holes, which no one has ever observed either. "You're so smart, why don't you believe in God?" she answered. Wonderful little retort. Sagan never set out to finish the work of the Enlightenment. "I started out very much enjoying the idea of an omnipotent God, who was like a benign parent," he wrote to one of his correspondents. "I was brought to skepticism by the lack of evidence. But if there is evidence of such a God, I feel it is my responsibility to try and know about it." Now that's an interesting attitude right there. Sagan developed many of these ideas in his 1995 book, The Demon-Haunted World. He managed there to suggest, with careful circumspection, that the evidence for most religion is not much better than for all the superstitious pseudosciences that people get involved in. Sagan's insistence on dealing only with evidence put his dialogue correspondence at a seeming disadvantage, at least until the time Campbell asked him this: "Carl, do you believe in love?" And he said, "Of course I do." He was very much in love with his wife. And I said, "Can you prove that love exists?" And at first he said, "Well, certainly." But eventually he agreed that love, like faith, has something unprovable at its core. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And that is exactly, you see, what he allows in contact. There's a possibility here. Have we really explained everything? His wife says there was no deathbed conversion. no appeals to God, and no hope of an afterlife. No pretending that he and I, who had been inseparable for 20 years, were not saying goodbye forever. Didn't he want to believe? She was asked. Carl never wanted to believe, she replied fiercely. He wanted to know. Fascinating article. What it shows us, though, is a man who, more than anyone else at the second half of the 20th century, was devoted to explaining the wonders of science, the majesty of science, which should satisfy our imagination and our sense of understanding of who we are. Even he recognized that there was more. Hence his quest for alien intelligence. He recognized that people of faith were onto something, that maybe not everything was provable. So much that he could engage in a discussion, a dialogue, as Sir John suggested we have. He was one of those scientists that Dawkins would consider to be too tolerant of religion. He, like Jay Gould, was looking for ways that maybe sensible religion and science could have a discussion. Part of the reason he was driven to this comes forth in his very last book, The Demon-Haunted World. If you want evidence for where modernity went, read this book. This is written by Carl Sagan at the end of his life, having spent most of his life educating people about science. And as he looked around in the 70s at the culture, what he saw was a rampant rush to the most ridiculous superstitions you could imagine. This was the height of the New Age movement. He could not understand why a whole culture so seeped in scientific education could become so rapidly disillusioned with materialism as an explanation, and were seeking in the East and Eastern religions and in superstition and in science fiction all sorts of pseudo-scientific mumbo-jumbo, all sorts of crazy superstition. And this book is a catalogue of all the crazy superstitions that people have. And it's a, you know, pleading for people to wake up out of this demon-haunted trance. He saw the decline of modernism. He saw the hunger for meaning, and he saw that people were looking for meaning in all these crazy places. And so the subtitle of this book, The Demon-Haunted World, is Science is a Candle in the Dark. Now that's a title you might have expected to find at the beginning of the Enlightenment, coming out of the Dark Ages, not 250 years after the Enlightenment. Science is a candle in the dark. Not at the end of a century of sort of universal, well, at least national science education, entirely on a secular basis, as Rosie just pointed out. You know, a century of science education, and he's talking about science as a candle in the dark. This is the state of anxiety that Carl Sagan had as he saw the decline in modernism. And with it, people searching for meaning in the most bizarre places. So much so that he actually puts out an olive branch to sensible religion in the face of all this crazy superstition, and tries to partner with sensible religion. Same thing was with Jay Gould and many other prominent scientists towards the end of the 20th century. Said, look, the warfare's gone on too long. You know, science and faith can live together. Now, if you wanted to be really cynical, you could say, well, they're just feeling forced to do that because they're not being able to win the day. But let's not be cynical. Let's give these men their due right. They really didn't want to have an ongoing war between science and faith. They just wanted to be careful of wacky superstition. They were respectful of a reasoned faith. Carl Sagan shows that respect. He goes even further in the book, because the movie is faithful to the book except in the very, very end. In the movie, she discovers aliens and encounters them and chats with them. And they're amiable folk. And they say, well, we've been around here for centuries. And she says, well, where did this all come from? And they say, well, you know, we don't know. And so here you find the intimation of an infinite regress, you see. We might find some sort of exalted beings out there, But then who made them? So we find the exalted being, who is so much more intelligent, the alien intelligence, but they then have to need an explanation. And in the movie, of course, it ends with her sort of, you know, this is still an open question. The universe has all these mysteries. We are not alone. There are others out there. But where it all came from, who knows? Open-ended quest. They're still figuring it out. In the book, what they do is they say, well, we're not sure where everything came from, but we have an idea, and we have a clue where it might be. It might be in the mathematical constant of pi. This isn't very good, is it? Pi. Pi holds the secret. So she comes back to Earth and gets her bank of computers that have been listening to the noise through satellite telescopes of the universe and processing that noise, looking for what? Looking for signs of intelligence. How do you find signs of intelligence? Well, you factor out random static noise, and you factor out rhythmic pulses, and you look for something that has the sign of what? Design. The sign of intelligence. Something that is clearly being crafted in a certain way. That is neither random nor just rhythmic. And that's what these computers have been doing. And that's how they heard the message from the aliens. Because they figured out, here's something that is neither noise nor just a pulse. It's communication. It's intelligent. It's crafted. So what does she do? She gets her computers to calculate pi. And of course, how many integers after the decimal point does pi calculate to? An infinite number, right? So the computers are, one computer is generating pi, and the other ones are analyzing. And this goes on for years, because pi is very long. And, you know, computers are running through pi, running through pi, and it's all random. All random, because that's the whole beauty of pi. These are entirely random. And every now and then a few little blips pop up that are sort of non-random, but then they dissipate back. And then way, way downstream, and this is the last lines of the book. Let me read it to you. This is Carl Sagan. She had spent her career attempting to make contact with the remote and most remote and alien of strangers, while in her own life she had made contact with hardly anyone at all. She had been fierce in debunking the creation myths of others and oblivious to the lie at the core of her own. She had studied the universe all her life, but had overlooked its clearest message. For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. She went back to the Argus computer that was so persistently and inventive in its attempts to contact her. She had it was programmed to alert her when there was an issue. Summarizing, she analyzes what the computer has found. Hiding in the alternating patterns of digits, deep inside this transcendental number, was a perfect circle. Its form traced out by unities in a field of noughts. The universe was made on purpose, the circle said. In whatever galaxy you happen to find yourself, you take the circumference of a circle, divide it by its diameter, measure close enough, and uncover a miracle, another circle drawn kilometers downstream of the decimal point. There would be richer messages further on. It doesn't matter what you look like, or what you're made of, or where you come from. As long as you live in this universe and have a modest talent for mathematics, sooner or later you will find it. It's there. It's inside everything. You don't have to leave the planet to find it. In the fabric of space and in the nature of matter, as in a great work of art, there is written small the artist's signature. Standing over and above humans, gods, and intelligent aliens, there is an intelligence that antedates the universe. The circle had closed. She found what she had been looking for. Now, I'm sorry I had to rush through that. But what she is saying, this is all imaginative, of course, it's fiction. But what she is acknowledging is that she has been looking for something in the search for aliens that is more than just evidence that evolution occurred on other planets. She is looking for something greater that can tell us where do we come from. And that is a hunger that everyone has. And what he speculates on here is it might be possible to find such evidence. Evidence that points not just to other creatures like us or other intelligences like us, but to an intelligence that antedates the universe. Something outside of the universe, outside of the natural sphere. Something transcendent. And what Carl is speculating on here is that it might be possible to find a signature of the Creator, a signature of an intelligence. Now, it's remarkable that he would even postulate that as a possibility. He apparently died believing that such evidence was not there. The kind of evidence he speculated on here is very interesting to reflect on. We don't have time to look at it now. But all I'm pointing out is that there have been a great many, even the most ardent advocates of science and of a naturalist explanation of everything that exists, that have been open and willing to dialogue and to recognize that science and the natural expression doesn't necessarily satisfy everything, that there are questions that it doesn't answer, and that there's a longing that it doesn't satisfy. And it's a tremendous acknowledgement for a man like Sagan, who tried to satisfy that longing by talking about the wonders of science. But he realized people need more than that. And speculated that maybe there isn't an intelligence that left its signature. Question is, what would that signature look like? Which brings me to my next scientist. We have to really...
John, I would think you also need to add Broca's Brain of his book, which he, I think, wrote before The Demons, because he looked into the whole idea about religion very clearly. He starts off quoting Rig Vedas with the Hindu holy books. And he says that the idea about what went wrong with the West is that they're looking not... The real religion, the scientific religion, but the symptoms of scientific religion. And I think that second book where he talks about demons, he says these are symptoms of scientific religion, which undermines the authority of religion. Broca's Brain is, of course, always a favorite book. I wonder why you didn't add to that list.
Well, I haven't read it, that's why I haven't. But I should, I suppose. Broca's Brain. Let me move on quickly here, and I want to talk briefly about another fellow, not a scientist, but a philosopher. But if Carl Sagan was the equivalent of Richard Dawkins in regard to naturalism and scientific naturalism in the 20th century, then Anthony Flew was the equivalent of atheistic philosophy to Richard Dawkins. He was every bit as much of a giant in his time as Dawkins is today. He was every bit as much an advocate of atheism as Dawkins is today. He was not a scientist, he was a philosopher. And he, in fact, had a long and illustrious career. Let me just see. I'm trying to think about how I can make this short. I really don't know how I can do that. The Times of London referred to him as one of the most renowned atheists of the past half century. One of his earliest papers, in fact, was delivered in Oxford in the 50s. Was a rebuttal of theism. He, as I said, many thinkers of the 20th century didn't bother to address theism. They thought it would die away. But he was a man of integrity, he wanted to actually show that there were cogent arguments against belief in God. And so he published in 1950 a paper called Theology and Falsification, which was to go on to become one of the most published papers of the time. And he argued there against the existence of God and for atheism. He studied philosophy under Gilbert Ryle, so he was very influenced by Wittgenstein and the fascination with linguistics. So his arguments are rather obtuse to those who aren't sophisticated in sort of language philosophy and so on. So I'm not going to try and review them at this point. But he went on to write many things, God and Philosophy in 1966, The Presumption of Atheism in 1984, and he really felt that he had soundly refuted theism philosophically. His style, of course, is very intellectual and academic and scholarly, so these books never became bestsellers in the way that Dawkins' stuff. He was writing really within the philosophical disciplines. But of course, he was not averse to debating. And he liked to debate, and he had many, many debates about the existence of God. And he was a man who, as he often said, he liked to follow the evidence. And he felt that if this is true, he should be able to defend it. And so he would enter and engage in debates. The interesting thing, and this is where our friend Sergio, he's not here at the moment, but his comment about dialogue is very important, because one of the men that he started debating quite a bit was Gary Habermas, an American apologist, an evangelical Christian. And over the course of time, they became friends. And in the interaction, not only in public, but in private through letters and correspondence and, you know, and conversations, Habermas began having an impact on Anthony Flew's thinking. And particularly a lot of the newer discoveries that were happening in the sciences. And Habermas brought to the attention of Anthony Flew a lot of newer discoveries in regard to the fine-tuning nature of the universe. The fact that the universal constants that regulate the universe and make it just this particular shape have to be absolutely precise. If they were even just slightly different, we would be in a very different kind of universe, and life could never have evolved, could never be sustained. So why are they just right? And it's not just one constant, dozens of them are just exactly right, not just approximately right, they have to be right to the, you know, to very, very, very careful precision. He also brought to Flew's attention the sophistication of the cell. At one time, you know, just as in the early days of physics, people thought, you know, the atom was sort of a discrete thing, and then, you know, molecules were built up with atoms. And it was only later that physicists discovered that the atom was a world in itself. It wasn't a simple unit. Well, early on in biology, of course, you could talk about the cell, you know, as some sort of a unit. Now we have gone into the cell, and we realize how incredibly complex it is. The chemistry, unbelievable. And could all of this have arisen sort of randomly? What could account for it? And he talked about the issues that the intelligent design folk mentioned, namely this sort of irreducible complexity. He also revisited David Hume. He was a scholar of David Hume. And he had always used a lot of Humean type arguments in his rebuttal of theism. And he revisited David Hume's arguments and came to see that maybe Hume had missed some things. The net result is that Anthony Flew changed his mind. Towards the end of his life, he came to acknowledge that it is now likely that there is a God. Now, he made it very, very clear he didn't become a Christian. Because in his mind, that meant an intervening God. A God who spoke, who messed around with the natural order. That was too much. Though he allowed that he could one day maybe get there. But at this point, he didn't really feel he could get there. His objection, his strongest objection, was the problem of evil. And he never was able to overcome that. But in regard to the brute existence of the cosmos, he became persuaded that there must be a God. He termed it Aristotle's God. He essentially became a deist. And he collaborated on a book, which was the last book that Hughes published, called There Is a God: How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. And he collaborated on this with a man called Roy Varghese, who is an evangelical apologist. So the book is most extraordinary, because what the book involves is essentially interviews with Anthony Flew that the editor sort of formulated into a storyline, articulating this change of mind. And then there's some appendices on the historicity of Christ and the intelligent design, and also you wouldn't expect to find. But all of this is done with Flew's approval. And what we see here is, just as the scientist Sagan, towards the end of his life, was willing to acknowledge an openness to other religious ways of understanding, here we have a philosopher, one of the most ardent defenders of atheism, towards the end of his life, going even further and saying that the weight of the scientific evidence in his mind now leans him very much in the direction that there must be an intelligent being behind all of this. Yeah?
Just wanted to check the name of the person who you said particularly engaged with him. And
Gary Habermas, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S, Habermas, yeah.
And who was the co-author?
Roy Varghese, V-A-R-G-H-E-S-E, Roy Varghese. It's a fascinating book. And it shows that indeed science is not always the enemy of faith. It shows that in fact having robust discussions and dialogue is not necessarily problematic. And in fact, if it's done in a civil way, and in fact if we take time to get to know an individual, it's amazing what fruit can come out of that. And it shows that the evidence can go in different directions. Now, someone else may assess that evidence and say, no, I'm still not persuaded. But even Dawkins recognizes a certain improbability that all of this happened through natural mechanisms. Flew, philosophically, because of his understanding of Hume, as much as he had banked much of his earlier refutation on Humean-type arguments, recognized that even Hume was not ironclad, and he could shift on the philosophical side, then could look at this evidence and see it with new eyes. And so he was able to recant his atheism. Friends, I want to stop so we can have some discussion. I haven't done justice. I mean, I have so much more I could tell you. I'd love to quote extensively. Brilliant stuff. Love to just give you long, long quotes. Love to talk more about Sagan. Interesting man. But I want to have some more discussion. All I'm trying to point out here is that, you know, there's everything to contend with here. Science is not an enemy. Science is the fruit of... science, you must remember, the scientific revolution came before the Enlightenment. Remember that. All too often people try to kind of hint that somehow science is the fruit of the Enlightenment. The scientific revolution started before the Enlightenment, within Christendom, as ancient Greek thinking re-entered the church via Islam, it has to be said, came back into the church and into the monasteries, and as Christian scholars opened to the fact that this wonderful God who created everything and designed it has called us to explore it. So far from the God of the Gaps argument that somehow if we acknowledge a supernatural designer we will give up on science, it was precisely the fact of a supernatural designer that encouraged early science. Let's see what he did. Let's figure out the mind of God. And early science flourished, particularly among Protestants, it has to be said. And all the early science institutes in Paris and in London and so on, the Royal Society and so on, were just, you know, 70-80% Puritans. Not just, you know, Christians, but Christians of a particular theological bent, doing good science. Now there have been, of course, times when We found ourselves on the wrong side of history and on the wrong side of science. But you know, there's times when science has been on the wrong side of science too. There are times when scientists have speculated in one direction and discovered that they've got egg on their face a few years later. So, you know, we all make mistakes, but there's no reason to feel that somehow science is either the enemy or that we just have to accept what anyone says in the name of science. And so because the new atheists speak as scientists down to us, we should not feel intimidated, and we can find many other scientists, many other theologians who have recognized that these are two different disciplines, theology and science, that often they are addressing different spheres of reality, and that there's plenty of room for both to flourish and to be mutually helpful, and that the areas of conflict need to be taken seriously, and we can have serious discussion and dialogue. But it's far too hasty to sort of say that science is disproved, faith, that God has been disproved, that we have to throw out the Bible, or any such reactions like that. In fact, many who have actually spent a lot of time looking at the latest discoveries of science, the Big Bang, for instance, that there is a beginning for centuries, the sciences as such as they were convinced that matter was eternal. Now they can't hold that anymore because contemporary cosmology talks about a beginning, which of course is what scripture talked about a long, long, long time ago, that there was a moment where things began in the universe. And many things, the fine-tuning and some complexity, speak of a complex creation that nonetheless was designed with a purpose that doesn't prove Christianity, but sits very, very well with the Christian revelation. That God made this world at a certain time, a certain moment, made it very specifically in a certain way, with certain structures and with certain purpose in mind, created within it certain fixed regularities, which is the basis, and he upholds those imminently, but also created a certain openness, and within it placed beings made in his image that can be creative like him, have a certain degree of freedom like he has, are not bound by those natural physical regularities. In that we have the flow of history, and we have all the humanities and the beauty of life. We have the whole moral dimension to life, all of which is very, very hard to sort of explain away on naturalistic premises. Speaks, I think, of a personal God, and we as persons in His image reflect that. And I think the plausibility of the Christian faith is as strong now as it's ever been, in my view. We'll have some discussion. Yes, sir. Sir Ron.
Thank you, God. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that after listening to some of your talks out of 13, I think I can scientifically make a kind of probability. Your lectures are like having that rhizome papaw in Sri Lanka. You need to wait until the last bit to know the fruit.
Oh, well, there you go. Good. I like to keep you waiting.
All right. My question is that your construction from morning, confrontational religious versus religious dangerous, and then you said faith is stupid, the deconstruction process of it, militarily problematizing the other side, and selectively rising, and all that you came. And then, of course, Carl Sagan and this other philosopher whom I thank. I got to know him, and too late.
I'm going to leave these books here, incidentally, so you can browse them. Mm-hmm.
But having listened to and gone through this path, one thing that strikes very, very clearly is that in this land of intellectual barrenness, isn't it the honesty of your pursuit comes as the final ingredient whether you are a Christian atheist or a scientist, that holds your contribution.
It's very, very important. I mean, this actually, if you read Anthony Flew, I mean, you weep for this man and you just love him because for all his strident, not strident, but all his strong opposition, you know, and writing all these philosophical papers, you know, he tells you his story in this very human fashion, you know, and you sort of feel how he kind of processed these things and some of his early childhood, you know, when he first considered the problem of evil, if a good God couldn't possibly do that, I can't go there. But he feels this principle, I have to follow the evidence. I have to be honest. Therefore, I will engage in debate, even though I don't really feel like it. I will do it. You know, and so there's this, you just admire this man's honesty, that he was willing to really, you know, he's not fudging. You know, he's going to try and follow the evidence. And if the evidence pulls me this way, then I have to go that way. At the end, he comes out, you know, sort of moving in a theistic direction, which is amazing and marvelous. But what really excites you, what really gains you, is a sense of honesty. And I think we have to be honest. And here I go back to my brother here. William, is it?
Will.
I mean, there are issues with God of the Gaps. I mean, you have right to have the sensitivities you do. We have ended up with egg on our face. And so we need to be careful. We need to be careful. We need to be humble. We need to be open and honest. We need to acknowledge, you know, that it isn't always as easy. I mean, I can kind of talk with a flourish here, you know, and we can be provocative and there's humor. There's a place for that. But at the end of the day, we also need to be very careful and try to go steadily because we don't want to inadvertently bear false witness, right? Having said that, we have every reason to be bold because we're not really speaking in our own right, you see. We are speaking on the basis of what God has revealed. And these things have been hard fought for. And so I think we need to sort of balance that sort of openness and that humility with a certain amount of courage to enter the dialogue and not to be intimidated and back away. And sometimes it's going to be more than dialogue. Sometimes it's going to be a very hard decisions that become politicized. We need to be careful about when the faith gets politicized. But you know, science has been politicized as well. And there's a history there that we should be very worried about. So everything can be politicized. And at a certain point, you know, things do become very, very serious. So we have to be careful, but we have to be courageous as well. There's a question over here. Yeah.
Well, I was just curious about, you know, I wish I paid more attention in college physics. But I'm curious, what is the Christian consensus on the age of the Earth? I've heard so much about, you know, science and millions and billions of years and 6 million Christians. What do Christians say?
I don't think we have a consensus. I think, of course, if we talk about the wider church, I think the vast majority take Genesis quite figuratively and simply acknowledge whatever science says. If we look at more that stream within the wider church of biblical Christianity, it really takes the Bible seriously as the Word of God to be read with some literal respect. There is also a range of thought. There are some who are literalists who would take it as sort of to be read precisely as it's written, 7 days, 7 24-hour days. They might even date, you know, the earth sort of along the lines of Usher, and you know, so 7,000 years, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there are some segments of the evangelical community who stand on that. But even those who pay the highest regard to biblical inspiration, who take the Bible seriously as the Word of God, every last jot and tittle as coming from God. Even there, we would say that it's communicated in subtle ways often. And so we need to recognize where it is being communicated in figurative or for poetic language and where it's being communicated in historical narrative. And so we don't read the Psalms the same as, you know, we read Acts or Chronicles. You know, we have to allow for the language. And the language of Genesis 1 and 2 is complex. And so we leave room for, if you like, recognizing the historicity of it, we leave room for a certain amount of figurative communication. And within that group of evangelical Bible-believing Christians, there are some who would argue that these days were meant to be understood as long periods. And so we don't have a problem with what geologists would say, that the earth is very, very old, you know, millions of years old. We don't have a problem with that. Others would say, well, it's not so much that each day is an era, but actually the whole schema of the days is a schema. And we're not meant to sort of think in terms of time, really, about just sort of different aspects of creation, God being behind all of them. You know, I think there's a healthy range of opinion. I think the conversations have become more respectful than sometimes they have been. Some people get very anxious about this. But I think it's advised, and going back to what I said a moment, to have a certain kind of, you know, humility to say, well, it's complicated interpreting. But there's certain things which seem very, very clear, which is that God is behind it all. That seems very, very clear. I think this thing didn't just happen spontaneously. What's more, God was behind in such a way to ensure that it resulted in the kind of world he wanted, a design world, a world with purpose. And that we were put in that in a very deliberate way. We're not just to be part of a natural process as human beings. We were very specifically put here. And very specific things happened, like the fall, that become problematic for us, which results and needs a very specific solution, which is the cross and the coming of Christ. That these things we need to have unity on as evangelical Bible-believing Christians. The other things I think we can allow some diversity on, and there is diversity there. Yeah. Sven.
A little comment to you. You have to ask, which kind of a hook is this? Which kind of a hook is it?
Yeah.
Is it a hook that can help us to be wise in scientific, but or is it
It's a good point, Sven. I mean, the Bible was written with a different task in mind than teaching us science. And so we need to be careful about that. And it's really teaching us theology. That's what it's teaching us. I think we can overstate the separation between those two. I think there is a contact point at certain points that we have to be wise to. But generally speaking, you know, the Bible is not a science book. Yeah.
Could you say a little bit about the significance of the New Atheist reaction to Anthony Flew and his book, because, like, the Ramblings of an Old Man, this kind of thing?
Yes. Well, how old is Richard Dawkins now? Talk about the Ramblings of an Old Man. I mean, you know, yes, we all get older. Some of us ramble on. I'm rambling on a lot these days. The question is, you know, the content of our ramblings. You know, I mean, we...
Explain the question.
Explain it?
Yeah, what he's quoting.
Well...
I don't think everyone knows.
Okay, well...
What the New Atheists have said about Flew.
Well, you know, I'm not sure exactly which one, but even before the New Atheists, I mean, as soon as this came out, I mean... Flew was a hero to many secularists. And so many of them were absolutely aghast that this had happened and contested that it really had happened. And on the blogs, I, in the interest of time, I can't, you know, I'd have to look back. I don't want to misstate dates and all that because I don't have it in my head.
When was it published, this book?
When was this book published?
Just published it, must be there on the third page.
Yeah. I'll give you that. This has all happened quite recently. 2007 is the copyright of this. 2007. The point I want to make, though, is as soon as this came out, you know, there were rumors of it about 3 or 4 years before he actually came out and said it. And the blogosphere went crazy about it, and people denied it. Then it came out so it was undeniable. Then people said he'd been taken advantage of by Varghese. You know, he's an addled old man, some evangelist got a hold of him and twisted his words. Then others said, no, he's just become senile. I've spoken personally to Roy Habermas. and asked him about this issue. And Gary has said what happened with him is utterly genuine. He's talked to him personally and talked him through. If you read the interview between Gary Habermas, which before this book came out, it was published in Biola, an interview which really threw the cat among the pigeons. There had been rumors. I think it came out in 06 or something. An interview between Habermas and Flood, in which, in his own words, you can read, this is a brilliant man. In 06, or whenever it was, that article came out. If you read, you cannot read that and tell me that this is an adult old man who's senile and lost it. I mean, he is as sharp as a tack all the way through that interview. Even in the book here, and of course it's a little harder because the book has been edited, so you can always sort of say, well, you know, it was pick and choose. But it's very clear, you know, he's not relating some emotional conversion experience. So he's talking philosophically. He's talking about science. He's talking at a very sophisticated level. And what he's talking about is becoming a deist, not even a theist, believing in Aristotle's God. So the arguments that somehow this is a man who's lost it, or this is a man who's taken advantage of, I do not think, I've looked into it, I do not think they have any credence at all. It was a cheap way of refuting him early on, before more of the evidence became apparent. I think now it's very hard to make that case. If you actually look at what he said, this is not a break through some, you know, psychotic episode or something in his thinking. This is the result of his thinking. The flow is very, very clear that this is the flow of his thought that came out. Does that help?
I think what I was really trying to get at is that it's significant that that's the approach the New Atheist took in order to discredit and dismiss it, rather than a truly scientific approach of weighing up the evidence. And that's why it's difficult, isn't it, to engage that level of rhetoric which you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I mean, this ad hominem approach is all too obvious. And that's what we're going to see in the film. So I want us to watch the film, because if you get past it and you just look at the arguments, I mean, it's complicated, but at least you can have a fair discussion. But when you start saying, oh, well, he only said that because he's old, I mean, you know, you're talking, arguing against the man rather than against the ideas. You see, so there's a lot of that going about. I think we're out of time. Sorry we didn't have more. I'm surprised you didn't challenge me on some of my rebuttals there. I must have been incredibly persuasive. Watch out for that. Watch out for that. Think. Don't just get persuaded.